All right. Hello, everybody. So Jeff and I are back. We took a bit of a break here due to some professional reasons outside of our podcast series, but we're happy to be back. We have a gentleman I served under at one point. He's got quite an illustrious career. Pretty interested to hear some of his stories, and especially now where he's ended up. Anyway, I saw him on Twitter, and I reached out. Would love to get his perspective based on Canadian defense policy, the Canadian Navy, and as well based on where he lives now, his perspective on China and why it matters to Pacific states as well as Canada. His name is Paul Madison. I knew him as Vice Admiral Madison. He was commander of the Royal Canadian Navy 2011 to 2013. But he has a lot of salt running through his veins. He's been, he was in the Navy, I think, since the late 70s. So a lot of different commands, both operational and staff-based, both in the Navy and in the Canadian Forces at home and abroad. So I'm going to turn over to him. I'd love him to kind of tell us a little bit about, what he's done and what he's up to. So I usually would call someone like this, sir, but he's poked me and told me to call him Paul. So Paul, I'm going to pass it over to you.
Yeah. Hey, thanks. Hello to your listeners, and thanks James and Jeff for inviting me into your podcast here on a lovely early summer Vancouver evening. It's actually just getting past the shortest day of the year down here. So we just had the winter solstice. So you Canadians are probably kind of trying to figure that out. So the good news from down here is that it's downhill now till the summer, and I'll be thinking of you when the sun sets at 4:45 in December. But anyway, great to be here. Thanks for the invitation. Look, I served in the Navy for quite a while. So I went to CMR when I was 17 in Saint-Jean, Quebec. Grew up in the Cold War, sailed on both coasts. I like to tell people I'm bi-coastal. So ended up commanding Calgary out of Esquimalt, commanded Iroquois out of Halifax, spent a year as the Force Anti-Submarine Warfare Officer in the old Standing Naval Force Atlantic. That's now SNMIG 1, I think. Mm-hmm. Pretty interesting time to be doing that. It was 1989-90, and the commander was German. So I spent 6 months in German frigates and was on board doing a JMC up off of Scotland on the 9th of November, 1989, when the wall came down. It was just an amazing experience to be a Canadian staff officer in a German flagship, watching these guys really lose their minds over, maybe not their minds. They were just so emotional over what this meant. And it was just an extraordinary privilege to be part of that. One thing led to another, and I had some great experiences as a flag officer as well. Certainly standing up the Standing Contingency Force back in 2005-06 was an amazing experience when Canada for a moment was driving towards a standing high readiness joint afloat task group. And
was this General Hillier's Big Honkin' Ships?
It was a bit more than that. He was the sponsor. He provided top cover and sort of drove the service chiefs to pay attention. And unfortunately, it kind of unraveled with Medusa, as Medusa pretty much in September 2006 took the entire collective bandwidth of the Canadian Forces leadership. Commanded in Halifax as the formation commander in the Joint Task Force Atlantic. That was really a highlight for me. It was an extraordinary experience, especially as we celebrated the 100th anniversary of the Royal Canadian Navy with Her Majesty the Queen coming for that fleet review back in 2010. Mm-hmm. And then commanded, as you mentioned, James, up until 2013. Wasn't quite sure what was going to come next, but you never know what doors will appear out of nowhere and hands will reach out, and you either take that hand and see where it takes you, or you kind of ignore it and you never know. So I was invited to come to Australia as Canada's High Commissioner, something I wasn't really anticipating at all. But given that my wife is Australian and our kids are dual nationals, it just seemed like an extraordinary opportunity and a great thing to do. So came down here in 2015 and just had a ball serving Canada in Australia. But also, I was accredited to 7 Pacific Island countries. And for me, that was a real highlight. So 3 countries across Melanesia, that being Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, and Papua New Guinea, and 4 countries across Micronesia, that being Palau, Nauru, Micronesia itself, and the Marshall Islands. And I just really love that part of the work. It's just an amazing part of the world. Very few Canadians get the opportunity to go to some of these places. Mm-hmm. You probably would be hard pressed, the both of you, to find Nauru on a chart. And it's and I just learned a lot and loved it. So and then, you know, one thing led to another, and we thought we might want to stay down here, and the University of New South Wales appeared. They were standing up a Defence Research Institute, mm-hmm. Looking for someone to lead it, and that became me. So for the last 2 years, I've been working pretty hard with my team here, sort of completely focused on Australia's defence research priorities, and working with defence, working with the services, working with the equivalent of DRDC to bring my university's world-leading research expertise across the entire spectrum of defence activity to bear on accelerating capability development for the ADF across the full sort of tiered readiness levels. So from, you know, fundamental basic research to you know, technical insertions to commercialized and deployed capability. And it's a really exciting time to be doing this in Australia, given the Indo-Pacific strategic settings. We're going to talk a bit more about that, I'm sure. Yeah. So that's where I am. And along the way, I became an Australian citizen, sold everything in Canada, haven't been there for a couple of years. Miss you guys. And, you know, someday when the pandemic's over, I might be allowed to come back and visit.
Well, you really haven't slowed down. It sounds like you, like, retirement's not really within your lexicon. Is that, you've just been going 1,000 miles an hour there. But Australia, I mean, it's beautiful. It's great for your family. I wanted to ask one thing. Do you come from a family that has served, or was there any naval background? What first attracted you to the Navy? I've always interested in what kind of attracts Canadians to
Yeah, Canada. It's all about family, James. So look, my dad was Air Force.
Okay.
He didn't serve in World War II. He was just a little too young. And so his parents sent him to St. Mary's in Halifax. My dad's family were Spring Hill coal miners. Mm. So he was the first in our family to get a degree. He graduated from St. Mary's in 1946. But his grandfather had served in World War I. And my dad wanted to serve. So he joined the RCAF in 1952. And so I grew up as a service brat. I was born in Moose Jaw because my dad was there. And But how I got into the Navy is my older brother, Greg, he went to RMC, wanted to be a pilot, didn't have the eyes. And so they gave him one of these, you know, typical sort of thing that they do at mill call. Okay, you can't be a pilot. So you got two choices. You can go to the, join the Navy or be an infantry guy. And so he went, okay, I'll join the Navy. And I'm 9 years younger than Greg. So, what I remembered was him coming home, talking about how much fun he was having in Mazatlan, Pearl Harbor, Lisbon, you know, Rosie Roads, and he brought his friends with him, and they always seemed to be having so much fun, and I thought, well, this will work for me. So I ended up going to CMR, mm-hmm. and I picked the Navy, and there you go. And
you
the interesting
you
thing
try
about
for
Greg
pilot?
Is, what's that?
You didn't try for pilot?
No. I
just read.
I went in as And there weren't a lot of guys at CMR back in the mid 70s that wanted to join the Navy, because the Francophones, and I wasn't even aware of this because I was 17, but in Quebec, it was sort of well known that the Navy was fairly anglicized, if I can put it that way, culturally, you know, with such strong traditions to the Royal Navy. So there weren't a lot of actually sailors at CMR, which is kind of interesting. But interestingly, you know, when I talk about my brother commanded the Navy as well. So mm-hmm. he commanded from 97 to 2001, and then he was the DCDS. He was the one who ran global operations after 9/11. So when JTF-2 went into Afghanistan and stuff like that, Greg was running that op. And yes, so the neat thing is, from a family perspective, we're the only two brothers in Canadian history to have commanded a service.
That's very cool. It's very cool. It's I love asking that because I don't think sometimes people appreciate a lot of the family roots that are within the Canadian Armed Forces. It always surprised me. It wasn't in my family background. It was I think my parents were a little shocked when I said, "Oh, I'm really interested in joining the military and really interested in joining the Navy specifically." But one of the things that's great, and you kind of touched on it in terms talking about the different Canadians and the different cities. When people ask me, you know, what is one of the more interesting or great things about the military, I will, you know, it took me maybe a couple of years after leaving to really reflect on it, was the exposure to different Canadians. Like just like the different cultures, you know, from the you know, doing basic training and having, I remember there was two individuals that I couldn't understand really very well because their Newfoundlandese was so thick. And then, you know, there was your Francophones as well that were just, you know, just trying to speak English and, you know, me not speaking French that well. And then just as well with all the different training areas, you also get exposed to a lot of different areas of Canada that I think Canadians just don't really take for appreciate, and they take for granted of how big this country is, how diverse the different people are. And especially a lot of the Canadian military comes from rural small towns across the country. So
I used to love taking sort of leaders from all sort of segments of Canadian society to see. And the Canadian Leaders at Sea program, which started up, I don't know, about 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was always the exact same thing happened. You know, these would be corporate CEOs or politicians or civil society leaders or, you know, impressive folks that we wanted to bring to see in order for them to understand and then be in a position to advocate for the Navy as a fundamental enabler of Canada's national security interests as a maritime nation. And it was always the same thing. They come on board the ship. Let's say it was a frigate. They'd look around and they'd see 5,000 tons of pretty impressive technology, and they would go, "Wow, this is such a fascinating ship." Yeah. You know, and what's that? That's a radar. And what's that? And what's this? But by the time we came back alongside and they were at the brow preparing to go ashore, they had completely forgotten about the ship. All they wanted to talk about were the sailors. Yeah. All they wanted to talk about was leading seaman or leading sailor, I guess now, leading sailor Smith from, you know, Estevan, Saskatchewan, who gave them a tour of the ops room, who was the most articulate, intelligent, motivated, and inspiring young Canadian they'd ever met.
Yeah.
And so to go back to your point, it's all about the people and really what makes the Canadian Armed Forces what it is as a profession of arms. It's the people we attract.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple more things on that too. And one, and I'm sure you would speak to this roundly, is any exercises, any operations that I was involved in, it was always, you know, I even like at one point served as a liaison officer on a Korean ship, was sitting back and looking, even if sometimes our technology was not as high speed as some of the Americans or some of our other allies, the performance based on the professionalism of our sailors and our soldiers, saw the same thing in Afghanistan, was always very remarkable. And I don't think sometimes people appreciate, we as an armed force, we're small, no doubt about it. But I will fight it tooth and nail to say we punch well above our weight, always have. And I think there has always been that attitude about it. And then just from the young junior sailor to the young to the officer, the leadership development and leadership opportunities. My mom was an executive within the bank, and she finally got to come on board on a sail when we were HMCS Vancouver in Port of Vancouver. I think it was under Aldous Sulcher. I was the navigator at the time, and she got teary. She was so impressed, and she was just, after I had done the passage out, and she just she goes, I don't know where, I think I was maybe 24, 25, a person of your age gets that type of opportunity in Canada. Yeah. She's like, it is remarkable. So
when did you navigate Vancouver?
Sorry, the years are going by. So it was, I got my ticket under Commander Bill Riggs, and then went and did the FNO. The FNO was on Vancouver, and did well enough that Commander Salchert asked me if I wanted to navigate a ship. So it was primarily under a chunk under Salchert, and then a chunk under Commander Knippel. So I was I got some great different experiences. I have a lot of heart for all of them, and because they're all very unique in their different ways. And I got to at one point I was Special Forces, but probably, I look very fondly on that. I also look very fondly on my time as a navigating officer. I was very proud of that. I still remember the time that I, passed my last passage, brought the ship to anchor, and it was, out in the bridge wing, handshake, and said, congratulations, you're a fleet navigation officer. And it felt like it felt like you're joining a fraternity that went back to the days of Captain Cook, and that's the one thing I've always appreciated about the Navy. And especially if you get into the navigation and driving of ships, which was something I always loved, is there's something timeless about it. It goes back to the, dawn of time, dawn of man, so to speak. Enough of the regaling of the things. I'm sure I could poke you a bunch about these stories, but what was interesting in terms of the time that we're in right now is kind of things have kind of gone for me full circle. So, and this is how I was attracted to the Navy, like most students out of in Calgary, you go to University of Calgary to do business or engineering because it's all oil and gas. I kind of went in there, didn't find it very attractive, and I ended up mistakenly taking a Canadian military history course that was a part of a new program for the Strat Studies Center. And I fell absolutely in love, started getting that. And then at that point, there was a lot of discussion based on some of the professors about an emerging, I don't want to say threat at that point. It was definitely an emerging thing. Everything at that point was about the Taiwanese Strait and this emerging tiger of China. China kind of resuming a position with the Pacific. I think at some point that might have been a little bit early to where we are now. The trends, everything talked about the Pacific being this new, very important theater, numerous sovereignty-based issues at sea and everything. And the time there was the Canadian frigate was coming up, all this stuff, there was a lot of things to track. That's what pulled me into the Navy. I got in whole hog into Asia-Pacific Security Studies at University of Calgary, and that's where I found myself in the Navy. 9/11 happened. Everything kind of fell. I think that the Pacific kind of took a back theater, at least in our eyes, not so much probably in number of the Asian states. namely China, but here we are now. And then one of the other things that's interesting was when I did my studies, Australia always popped up as something that seemed somewhat more coherent in foreign policy, defense policy, and especially the Pacific. And that's when I saw that you were there. I was very interested to kind of get your take.
Right.
So over to you, Paul. Tell me what's going on with Australia and a bit about China, if you can.
Sure. I
appreciate that.
There's a lot there.
There is.
You know, when I went to staff college in Toronto in 1992, 93, I wrote a paper. The title was The Battle of the Spratly Islands. Mm. And so the reason I bring that up is, and of course, my thesis was that the Canadian Navy was not first developing at a rate required to meet the threat. So this is 30 years ago. So it's not new. And, yeah. And folks were raising flags way back when. And you know, the West Coast, you know, the MARPAC was kind of like a lone voice in the wilderness because we deployed steamers and frigates into Asia Pacific, because we networked with the senior American and like-minded naval leaderships in Japan, South Korea, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, etc. We shared a common view, and Esquimalt was always, you know, working hard to influence strategic thinking in Ottawa, and trying to gently nudge Ottawa away from a Eurocentric, NATO-focused world, you know, Cold War legacy strategic lens. And it was very frustrating.
Yeah.
The other thing I would add is that when I was in Colorado Springs in the late 90s, you know, working in across the NORAD U.S. Space Command divide, and so working with the U.S. intelligence community, and Canadians, obviously, just prior to 9/11, the intelligence community was pivoting to the rate at which the CCP threat was evolving, and the writings of certain PLA colonels on asymmetric warfare, in terms of attacking critical infrastructure and all that kind of stuff, that was really starting to get people's attention.
Yeah,
yeah. 9/11 happens. I'm down there, so I watched it happen. And the entire sort of strategic and sort of whole of nation defense and security power base just pivoted to Afghanistan and Iraq. Mm-hmm. And, you know, history will, I think, show that was there was a missed opportunity there, or yeah, we took our eyes off the ball. And so while we were all fixed in a land air battle in Afghanistan, although from an American perspective it was a sea land air battle, China was left to continue to do what they needed to do, and the lazy assumption that we made, and I was among I was with everybody else making this lazy assumption, was that the Chinese Communist Party would incrementally democratize on greater exposure to the rules based international order. You know, being welcomed into the World Trade Organization, et cetera, et cetera. We just almost arrogantly assumed that every human being on the planet naturally would gravitate towards any form of governance in which they had freedom of choice. Well, it doesn't work that way. And everything kind of went pear-shaped when Xi Jinping came to power in 2012. Mm-hmm. And the China watchers were paying attention. When I came down to Australia in 2015, Australia was the only G20 nation that had, could boast at that time, I think it was 27 years, of economic growth without recession. You know, Canada couldn't do that. US couldn't do that. Nobody could do that. Australia could. Why? Because of economic relationship with China. So as China grew, and as it built cities seemingly in weeks, the iron ore that generated the steel was coming out of Western Australia, and the coal that was powering and continues to power Chinese industry was coming out of Queensland and New South Wales. Mm-hmm. And the wine that and lobster that Chinese the growing Chinese middle class was suddenly able to afford was coming out of Australia, and mm-hmm. the universities that were attracting middle class Chinese students to get a world class education in a really cool country and learn English and all that kind of stuff, they were coming here. So mm-hmm. the economy was on fire, and but there were real seams emerging. And it's taken a while for everybody to kind of come to grips with what has happened. But I think the turning point was the 19th Congress in 2017, the 19th Party Congress. And when Xi Jinping, the messaging that he laid out at that Congress, and this is where he set the conditions for himself as Commander-in-Chief of the PLA, he set the conditions for him as basically the dictator for life. And by that time, he had removed any kind of political opposition under the guise of anti-corruption measures. By that point, it was becoming clear that there was a great power contest back underway. Mm-hmm. And, you know, different nations have sort of approached this differently. Australia, canary in the coal mine's a bad term, but there's a lot of people that argue that Australia was kind of the proving ground for the CCP. It's kind of like the South China Sea. Everybody says to the CCP, look, you can't do that. Yeah. It's illegal. We have an mm-hmm. international tribunal, arbitral ruling in support of the Philippines. You can't do that. And yet, you know, China's response all along was, well, look, you know, this is ours. And we're not really militarizing. We're generating search and rescue capacity such that we can make the world a better place. And, you know, diplomats would go, okay, well, all right. But other people would look at that and go, well, that's a crock. Come on.
Yeah.
And so in Australia's sort of example, there's a view that the CCP was using, what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of influence activities politically at the municipal, state, and federal levels. They were involved out of the embassy and consulates general with the United Front activities, doing things that Australians woke up to and realized that the influence was unwelcome and it was against the country's core sort of national security and sort of values-based interests.
Paul, can I just ask you, and Jeff, please rhyme off me on this one. Have you had any like big bestsellers or any things that have kind of come out in the media about what you were just talking about? We've just had one a couple of weeks ago. There's a gentleman here by the name of Sam Cooper, a journalist that's been doing a lot of work, and he just came out. Are you aware of his one book that he just came out with?
Yeah, I've seen some action on it on Twitter. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I'm halfway through it now. Quite impressive, but it speaks, and he's been speaking as well as like Charles Burton from the McDonald Laurier Institute and all the same thing in terms of influence-based operations, intelligence gathering, things from right down to the municipal level, all the way up to the federal. It's pretty remarkable. Yeah. And so everything that you're saying about Australia, we're going through that awakening right now in Canada.
Yeah. Sorry,
go ahead.
No, I would just say that Canada, one of the things that kind of struck me when I was High Commissioner was that folks in Ottawa figured they knew the Indo-Pacific well enough, thank you very much, and didn't really need to respect Australia's position as much as they should. And my argument was, look, If you're going to come out here from Ottawa, and if you're going to represent Canada legitimately and credibly, you really should take the time to seek the advice of a nation similar to Canada that, unlike Canada, actually sits on the inner vortex of the inner eye of the vortex, which is the Indo-Pacific.
Yep.
And so I think, you know, I like what I'm seeing in Canada in terms of an awakening to the threat. But I would say that Australia is a few years ahead of Canada in that regard. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that, you know, one of the things that happened just before I left as High Commissioner, of course, was the arbitrary detention of the two Michaels.
Yes.
And the upside of that, if there can be an upside, was that it caused Ottawa and specifically Global Affairs Canada, but also, yeah, well, I'll just leave it there. So the minister, the deputy and senior sort of mandarins, to reach out deliberately to Australia and to put some structure around, okay, we need to share context. We need to share assessment. We need to share analysis. We need to share best practices. And so I'm assuming that since I've left, that's actually continued and probably gotten stronger, because there are Australians that are also arbitrarily detained, not quite with the same public face around the Huawei Hmong thing, because the Australian government has chosen to keep this to a dull roar in the public domain.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot going on there where Canada and Australia are exchanging, so that's good.
Can I maybe ask a question just because, yeah, you would have had the insider baseball, and me not having served in the military, although my family did before me. I it's a bit of a pet theory. You mentioned serving, being involved around the time of 9/11 and then the subsequent wars in the Middle East after that. And I've always had a sense that in hindsight, the real damage that those wars ended up doing was they turned the public away from any sort of military intervention, because those wars themselves turned into such disasters for the U.S. that there was a general disinterest from the average person in getting involved in other people's, in other nations' affairs, wherever they are. And I don't know if that, seeped into the military, you know, hierarchy itself. But I'd be curious on your take on that, because I think that you said earlier that we just took our eyes off the ball because we were involved in the Middle East. But I think there's also a larger element where there became just a huge public, a lack of public interest in intervening anywhere in any sort of way. And that maybe stymied some of our ability to head this off at the pass.
Yeah. Good point, Jeff. You know, there's always an ebb and flow in public opinion.
Yep.
And if you go back to Canada's involvement in Afghanistan, the public opinion was never for engaging as part of the NATO sort of ISAF against the Taliban, you know, ostensibly to root out Al-Qaeda. But there was an incredible support for the men and women in uniform who had volunteered to serve Canada and Canadian interests and who were deployed in Afghanistan. That was, and for somebody who had lived through a couple of decades of Canadian apathy towards anybody in uniform, I got to tell you, that period of like 2006 to 2011-12 was pretty exhilarating.
Mm-hmm. And, I'm sure.
And, you know, you remember the Highway of Heroes and stuff like that. I mean,
absolutely.
You don't want to be bringing fallen home in order to generate interest in the armed forces, but it really did bring Canadians together around supporting what the Canadian Armed Forces stood for. And I give Rick Hillier a lot of credit. He was a great communicator. Of course, mm-hmm. He upset the politicians because he actually had a name and a face that Canadians recognized. But I don't think that strategically intelligence services and senior leaders in defense, foreign affairs, in PCO, et cetera, I don't think they were wanting to avoid conflict. I just think that all of the available bandwidth was applied without exception to keeping our troops enabled to be successful in Afghanistan and to come home.
Because I still sense this a theme of this in the U.S. in U.S. politics now is that there is a huge, and there always has been in the U.S., such admiration for their men and women in the service and in uniform, that it's almost like there's a feeling of, why are we throwing young people away at stupid wars overseas? And forgetting that there were times when we needed to do those things in order to head off major global threats. And I just worry to some extent that the Iraq wars and Afghanistan and all of the involvement there has paralyzed us a bit to confronting true threats. That's my, you know, and that's not, that has almost nothing to do, I think, with, you know, respect for people in uniform. It's just, it's almost a, because of the respect that it's not worth, there's a feeling that it's not worth throwing them away over silly, you know, conflicts on the other side of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you. You know, for a lot of people, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq were highly discretionary conflicts. Mm-hmm. Would the world be any different if we hadn't have gone?
I don't know if it's the right. I'm not litigating whether it was right to go or not. It's just the fallout is, I think, like I said, I think there is a huge reluctance on the political side to try to open up a new front while they're still trying to close the old one.
Nobody's trying to open up a front. Except a potential adversary.
Right. Well, I understand that.
What I find, what I'm thinking, interesting, Paul, is, you know, you played a large part in of your service within the Cold War. And there's almost like that mm-hmm. emerging type of environment in some way or shape is coming back again. I think back also to that time of, I sometimes call it the peacekeeper myth, which I feel as Canadian Armed Forces have always had to try to kind of overcome that, hey, we're not just peacekeepers. There's a lot more to us. And there was that element of, was it Lloyd Axworthy? Soft power, the discussion and the push of always soft power. Do those things, like those tenets of like soft power, kind of the peacekeeper element, do Canadians have a willingness to look at their armed forces differently? Also to look at maybe their foreign policy a little bit more serious with something like China? Do you think that there is a potential there based also on your observations and time, you know, during the Cold War?
So I would say, Jamie, that it's the responsibility of the government of the day to communicate frankly and honestly with Canadians. I say the same thing here in Australia. You need to lay out what are Canada's interests? What are the values that we recognize as core? And which if sort of existentially challenged, we will have no choice but to respond.
Yeah.
And that kind of communication has to, you know, politicians are very reluctant to have those sorts of conversations because it makes them uncomfortable. Often it's easier just to not say anything. And this is exacerbated by the echo chambers of social media silos. You know, losses, you know, the measurable loss in public confidence and social cohesion that has come in this sort of Facebook era that we're in. And so if politicians can't be honest with Canadians, how can you expect Canadians to come to their own conclusions about what should be the right decisions that will be made on behalf of Canadians and Canadian interests? But, you know, inexorably here, we are seeing what the CCP is laying out. Mm-hmm. We are seeing the challenges to the system of the world, yeah. As we that we grew up in.
Yeah.
We are seeing the beginnings or the shape of where that red line might be. And we're you know, as you look at the trajectory of the CCP towards 2049, you know, the 100th anniversary, when you look at Xi Jinping's assertion that they will have achieved, the PLA will have achieved equity with the U.S. and her allies by mid-2030s, when you look at the CCP's a doctrine of military civil fusion, in which they basically take the very impressive corporate and state research enterprises, so the technology institutes, the universities, and are able to, through authoritarian governance, direct the human capital to be focused on accelerating the drive to have competitive advantage in things like hypersonics, bioengineering, robotics, undersea surveillance, space offensive and cyber offensive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When you see all of that, and then you listen to the rhetoric around coming out of China around the decline of the United States as a credible, legitimate democracy. And unfortunately, the Americans keep kicking own goals here.
they're not helping that narrative.
No, like, Trump was an unmitigated disaster and continues to be. And there are still alarm bells ringing all over the United States, which with harmonics clanging in Ottawa, Canberra, London, Paris, Berlin, Tokyo, et cetera, et cetera. So all this is kind of happening here, and the design of what could happen between now and mid-century is becoming clearer. I guess the good news is that we're seeing a sort of a coalition of the competent beginning to coalesce around having a consistent stance on what is acceptable behavior out of Beijing and how we collectively, not as individual countries, not Trudeau doing his thing or Biden doing his thing or Boris Johnson doing his thing, but how will we collectively speak with one voice and act as one sort of Western democratic tradition with a huge sort of economic weight that brings out of the EU, out of the US, and out of everyone else, when you bring in Canada, Australia, Japan, et cetera, how do we develop that grand collective strategy? Mm-hmm. And how do we apply it then, in a way that hopefully can influence decision makers in Beijing in such a way that we can avoid major regional or even global conflict. This is the question of our time.
Yeah, it's I was, I don't know if I was reading it or listening to it about the Taiwan and the Taiwanese Strait, and it definitely caught my attention when someone else within the defense community saying, there is the chance within the year that China will take action towards Taiwan. Within the next 5 years, highly probable. And, it's kind of like, whoa, going back to my studies in 96, it's like, wow, now it's happening. It is here. I know as we as humans always lack the imagination to see like what really it is coming around the corner, but there is something definitely pushing. And, as Xi looks to solidify his power and has purposes has to, and solidify his power. He's gotten Hong Kong, and or I think most of Hong Kong now is pretty much under the thumb of the CCP. Taiwan is kind of the one remaining thing there. Is that 1 to 5 years? Is that, do you think that's credible, or do you think that's kind of like, no, we've got a longer runway than that?
I think it's credible. I think the CCP's kind of modus operandi has been to, you know, to win without fighting, and to do that by stretching their ambitions right to that edge where they assess the rest of the world
response
is just not good, can't accept that. Yeah. And that's what we saw in the South China Sea. And, you know, it's like a death by a thousand cuts. And so now it's that fait accompli.
Yeah.
And Taiwan obviously remains a core strategic objective. Militarily, wow, what a challenge. I know it's been war gamed and you know, you can go on and look at open source material and see,
yeah,
you know, how the PLA would kind of roll in, and yeah, there's books been written about it and stuff like that. But, you know, the potential loss of life and devastation of infrastructure is kind of hard to imagine. And so I think their near-term goal, I think, is more along the info ops campaign. It's basically to break the will of the Taiwanese people, to break the will of the government, and to just get them to a place where they realize that even if they don't give in to the CCP and they end up being invaded, nobody's going to come and help them anyway.
Yeah.
And that's actually a real possibility. There's a poll that came out in Australia today, which said that the majority of Australians would not support Australia standing by the Americans if they got into a fight with the Chinese, ostensibly over Taiwan. Although a majority of Australians, although only 10% of Australians now have a positive view towards China and the CCP.
So while there's kind of a psyop going on in Taiwan to weaken their will, there's a simultaneous one happening to the Western democracies to kind of placate and downplay and neuter our ability to respond, or our sense of what the threat is. And you said a couple of minutes ago about there needs to be a credible coalition of Western governments and democracies that can draw a line in the sand together. And I guess the difficult question is Canada in that list, or are we not? Because I know that there's been some shakeouts in the last year or two that may point that we're on the outs with some of the international intelligence and security community. I know, just going back to Sam Cooper's book, he came up, you know, there was the big FBI sting with the Rome or Soam, the encrypted cell phones that were distributed or all around, you know, throughout the criminal networks. And it seems like everybody was involved in that except for the RCMP, who didn't know it was happening, and no arrests were made in Canada. And that was probably linked back to the head of the RCMP, James, what was it, 2 years ago, being done for probably leaking and selling information to CCP agents. Is that fair? I forget the name of the gentleman, but
Ortiz there. Yeah.
I mean, between that and our position on Huawei, we seem quite at odds with our allies when it comes to some of these things. And I don't know if that's a read for, if that's the correct read militarily.
Yeah. I think, you're talking about the RCMP Intel director there, Cameron Ortiz, which I think some people have alluded to has caused Canada a considerable amount of damage. And now there's also discussion, I don't know if there's any connection to it, but the two scientists from the Wuhan lab that were kicked out, I think kind of at the same time that the Intel director was caught. I can only speculate, but I imagine that Five Eyes community would be very leery in intelligence sharing, unless it was with Canada, unless it was absolutely certain that its information was secure and safe from potentially any Chinese eyes. So I'm pretty sure that must have done some considerable damage.
So look, there's always there's always going to be these burps where, you know, an Ortiz or a you remember Delisle and of course the Americans have a litany of folks who have betrayed their country, and whenever these things happen, the first thing, you know, the intelligence chiefs get a hold of one another and brief one another to let them know, you know, how big or how bad or how not so bad things are. and things do normalize over time. I'm not really across the particulars here, and if I was, I wouldn't be able to talk about it, I'm sure.
Exactly.
But my sense is that, well, I'll tell you one thing. I don't see a voice, you know, from my looking through my lens here from Australia, where I focus a lot on the alliance with the United States, the relationship between Australia and Great Britain, the strong strategic partnership between Australia and Japan, South Korea, Singapore. Canada is never mentioned in these discussions.
Yeah.
And not to put too fine a point on it, but I just don't think the Trudeau government
cares.
Is credible on the world stage.
Yeah, I've heard that from a number of people. Yeah.
If Prime Minister Trudeau or his ministers go into a meeting talking, you know, about progressive economic trade relationships or
Green New Deal revolutions.
Yeah, whatever. I mean that's all good stuff. And you know what? You know, I really enjoyed being High Commissioner down here early in Trudeau's first government, because the messages were always such a joy to deliver. You know, reconciliation, which is 100% something I passionately believe in. Applying climate science to trying to get ahead of the climate catastrophe that we are in. 100%, I'm there. But in the more pragmatic world of tyrants and thugs who are leading governments in Moscow and Beijing and Tehran and elsewhere, this kind of new age approach to sort of winning over hearts and minds gets zero traction.
Unless you're
in an echo chamber in Davos,
or you're
hanging around with Bono in New York. I mean, it's all good stuff, but it's not what's needed right now. Yeah. And I don't think Canada has a strong voice. Certainly there's nothing I've heard from Minister Sejan in 5.5 years that I think would get anybody's attention amongst a ministerial meeting. And I'm not trying to be political here. I'm just, whereas
just down here,
in Australia, the relationship, there's a laser focus on Washington. There is a foreign minister and defense ministers meeting every year with the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense. And those meetings are really crunchy. And it's about what's happening in the Indo-Pacific. It's about what the CCP is doing along the One Belt Initiative in the Southern Pacific, in the island nations that I mentioned to you earlier. What's happening with ASEAN? What's happening with India? What's going on, you know, writ large in the region, and how are we preparing now to fight if necessary, and all of this kind of stuff. That's where I work every day is in trying to leverage UNSW's research capacity to have greater effect on accelerating capability with the Americans too. I mean, a lot of the research that we do at my university is U.S. funded. Mm-hmm. It's coming out of U.S. service labs. It's coming out of DARPA. It's coming out of the Air Force Research Lab. It's coming out of Monterey, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And that's where the focus is, because people are really serious about sovereign interests and the threat that's rapidly building. And folks are committed to doing everything they can to be prepared. So when you compare defense policies, Australia and Canada. What's it called? Secure, safe, engaged, or whatever in Ottawa. SS, the policy that came out in 2017. I don't think it's fit for purpose. And what you see down here, the defense strategic update that came out in 2020, the force structure plan that underpinned it, and the defense science and technology strategy that came out alongside it, is a commitment to spend $270 billion in this decade around new capability. Yeah. And going along with that is a growing annual defense spend, which is now at about $45 billion. And so Australia is a country with two-thirds the economy of Canada, but significantly greater defense spend. Why? Well, the obvious reason is they don't share a 9,000-kilometer border with the United States. So there's no sort of leverage you can get from that the way Canada has always done that.
Relied. Yeah.
And then there's this sort of historical kind of view here in Australia that we're alone and afraid. An island continent in this part of the world. And we've been invaded by Japan. Mm-hmm. Things were nip and tuck in 1942. The Brits had basically departed the field because Churchill, you know, had to focus on defending his island nation. Mm-hmm. And it was the Americans that basically came in and saved the day here. It's a lot. We could have a long sort of chat about Australian 20th century history, but it's just a different landscape. And I feel more comfortable engaging in these sorts of strategic conversations with ministers, with corporate chief executives, with university vice chancellors, with media here than I would in Canada. I kind of feel that Canada's changed for me in a way that, given my background, I'm not sure I'd get much purchase.
I agree with you. I've heard a number of people, peers, within the military that say similar things. It has been a frustrating experience. As I said, and we discussed, there is an awakening happening in Canada, but there's also other things going on. And I feel sometimes that, I'll be very gentle here. I've used more harsh words, but we just do not have credible political depth. And
we're not a serious country.
Not a serious. We don't play to a serious country.
I just don't feel it on the
internet. Yeah, and our defense and foreign policy, like real world politics, is not on the radar whatsoever. And you even look at through social media and that, I can see a lot of strategic thought. There's always good strategic thought in the States, but there's some deep and rich stuff still within the UK and Australia. I don't really follow. I don't get much of anything from Canada. There's just not much there, which is surprising based on our geostrategic position. I do know a couple people to kind of follow, but that's because I'm really looking. But there's just the real world politic is not there. And
I mean, I'll give you an example. Here in Australia, every state has set up a sort of an defense industry research network. So every state has self-organized. So in New South Wales, there's 9 universities. The 2 biggest are mine and the University of Sydney. And the Defense Innovation Network is set up and sponsored by the state government to drive on research, to generate new capability across the defense and security space, but also to spin off new companies, attract new jobs, to bring in talent from around the world, although it's kind of hard right now, but to attract talent, to build sovereign defense capability. Like in this country right now, in Australia, the government is driving on a sovereign high-speed weapons manufacturing capability. So there's a real drive on offensive and defensive hypersonics. I mean, I'm working in this space, and you know, I'm pretty impressed. Here's a country of 25 million people who have looked at some of the supply chain issues around defense capability and said, well, you know what? We need to design, build, and deploy high-speed weapons in Australia. So let's do that. What's it look like? Oh, well,
I mean, that is a conversation I have never, and I'm not in the circles, but that is a conversation that I have never heard a glimpse of in the Canadian context. The idea of provinces being any relation whatsoever to a national security issue is just totally, total black box.
So in every state capital here, you have these networks that are focused on vectoring industry towards generating deployable capability for the ADF of tomorrow. Because everybody knows that if the trajectory in the Indo-Pacific continues down the path it's on now, that there's a very real potential future which requires folks to deploy and act across the spectrum of operations, including full intensity conflict or combat. And if you're going to do that with volunteer men and women in uniform, you've got to give them that competitive advantage. I mean, that's the social contract. You don't send folks, we could talk. I don't want to go down.
If you're in Trudeau's government, your question would be, well, how many carbon credits are you reducing by doing that? Like, what's the real, you know, how many women are going to be sitting on these boards? What kind of bathrooms are we going to have at the frontline operations? You know, the really important
questions.
Those bathrooms
count. I'm a sailor and I'm here in these new ships. Like, they've come with we call them heads per cabin. And I'm like, wow, now that's a big leap, and hot water. So Jeff, you don't understand, but
as sailor, what I was referring to, but you know what I mean?
It's,
here's my
shipbuilding program is like, yeah, oh goodness.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit of a challenge down here too. The Type 26, you know, it's a bit of a challenge. But they're driving towards it, and they're driving towards a new 12 submarine program, not without some challenges. And if you talk to Australians in defense procurement, you know, they sound like they're in Ottawa. You know, why can't we get our act together? You know, why can't we learn from past failed programs? But what's the difference between Canberra and Ottawa is that there is a nonpartisan collective sort of will across the city here to get it done. Whereas in Ottawa, you've got, well, I always like to say that I've been disappointed by both major political parties through my entire career. I mean, you know, even the Mulroney government was disappointing. And don't get me started on Kretchen and stuff like that. So, and Mr. Harper, he also didn't.
Well, it wasn't the biggest increase actually under Martin. And I heard another Australian in a conversation telling me is the difference is we don't. He said Australia generally sees its defense policy is not as a partisan issue. It is kind of like. All kind of political parties see the importance of it and they're all kind of driving toward it. Is that, do you agree with that?
Yeah. Well, except the Green Party, but the Green Party is
not as much.
Not yet kind of mainstream.
But I feel like here, I mean, the issue is like, and this kind of goes back to the reason why I was asking the very first question about the Iraq war and kind of the feeling in the general population is that I think the Trudeau government is very calculated and has a very good understanding of what is a sellable story to their demographic. And I think their calculation is that this doesn't matter to the people who vote for us. So why is it, you know, it's not a priority to us. And my hope is that with Sam Cooper's books and some of the, you know, the Huawei and even kind of the pressure from the Michaels and having, you know, Ming Wei Zhao in Vancouver, that starts ramping up, the people say, wait a second, what are we doing in the world stage? Why are we not, you know, preparing? Why are we so behind the, feel like so behind the eight ball and all these issues that are happening? And that it starts to light a fire under people to actually get something done. But I'm not hopeful. I mean, I take the under on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not that hopeful. And I don't think it, I think Canada's military history is full of a history of an generally under-equipped military that scrambles in the time of conflict to play catch up, and usually on the backs of its members that get the job done with duct tape and whatnot. You know, so kind of lets our politicians off the hook in some way or shape, but it's always kind of in the background, and until it's not in the background and it's directly in your face because something bad has happened. So it's, maybe that's a little too pessimistic or cynical, but I think a lot of our history shows that. So, and China is a very interesting thing that I think based on our geography, based on our economy and all that, is going to become a very pressing issue. It already is a pressing issue, and hopefully we do have a lot.
Well, it's a live issue, right? I think that's again what Sam Cooper talks about, is that like it's a live issue, and China has been working behind the scenes for a number of years in a very kind of, you know, slow but very, you know, continuous game of manipulating institutions within the countries that they know they need to kind of influence. You know, you see it in Vancouver and Toronto, just a huge buying of property, which again, it seems like it's been linked to state agents as well as kind of narco trade. And it's all a big kind of things that if the Chinese government didn't want it, they could clamp down on it as well. But they understand that it helps destabilize the nations that they need to be working against. So I, like I said, I'm not hopeful, but I guess it sounds like we're kind of starting to wrap up here, but I guess a question would be, besides militarily, both militarily and politically, what steps could a government in Canada be taking to be more proactive against the threats coming from China? Both, like I said, on an intelligence front internally against whether this internal agents of what's it called, the
United Front
workers, whether that's internal or whether it's more kind of overt military strategic planning.
Sorry about the dog in the background.
That's okay.
I think the Canadian government could start by being honest with Canadians.
Yeah.
Sort of laying out the threat space, making it clear to what degree Canadian institutions and infrastructure have been under concerted attack over several years, where the compromises have been the most grave, and be prescriptive in whatever legislative changes that they need to make. You know, I work for a university, and I've watched how the university has had to pivot from an enormous international student revenue base out of China, which is still there. But it had to pivot to also taking foreign interference on campus.
Seriously.
Foreign interference with our researchers involved in 1,000 talent programs, for example, and implemented legislation that requires the universities to actually pay attention and to ensure that they have the oversight processes, the due diligence, the reporting mechanisms, and the investigative capacities, as well as the leadership priorities to ensure that universities are first and foremost geared in the national interest. I'm not sure that that's happening right now in Canada. You guys are in Vancouver. UBC is an interesting example.
I went to UBC, and I know, you know, this gets into a line that CCP has been feeding Canadian politicians. It's clearly coming out of their mouths now, which is that, well, we can't go, you know, passing legislation that's going to be deemed racist against Chinese international students or Chinese Canadians, which is a totally fair thing. But that has to be separated from the real threat of Chinese agents, and there's a naivety in Canada that that's not a thing here. That's you know, only we only read that about that stuff in spy novels or in movies. And it's no, it's happening here. We need to be aware of it. We need to differentiate what the people we need to protect and the agents who are seeking to undermine our institutions and our national security.
Right. And the folks in those national security agencies and institutions know exactly what's happening in Toronto and in Vancouver and in Montreal and everywhere else.
And is it, they can't get it done.
Well, it's not about not getting it done. It's okay. So they know what's going on. And yes, you how you share this publicly, how you attribute, is a political decision. But being completely silent, and letting Canadians kind of try to figure it out by reading books like Sam Cooper's or McLean's or something. That's not doing what governments are accountable to do.
Mm-hmm.
The director general of the CSIS equivalent. In Australia. So in Australia, there's two organizations. One is the Domestic Intelligence Service and one is the Foreign Intelligence Service. The Domestic Service Director General, he speaks publicly. And he, of course, he speaks in an unclassified way, but he speaks very clearly when he does about the threat of foreign interference in Australia. And he doesn't just talk about the CCP, because we all know that there are other actors. And some of those actors are our friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and so it's, but most Canadians just don't, aren't
there's
enabled.
No publicity. Yeah.
No. It's good when people stand up and go, hey, look, yes, we're focused on the CCP and we're focused on the Russians and the Iranians, but we're also focused on the Israelis and the Americans and the French. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot going on. This is what it looks like, and this is how, and this is our assessment as a country, and this is what we think we need to do to mitigate some of the risks that are already inside our lines, and sort of, you know, talking about trade and whatnot, and sort of, you know, and having a non-decision around Huawei. That just confuses people. So they just don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really sticking point. Okay. Any other final thoughts, James?
No, I like I said, if we go on any further, I'm just going to start pressing Paul for old salty tales. Cause I know he's full of them and I know they'd be great, but no,
yeah, I can tell you some great cultured and nipple stories, but I'll save that one for the next one.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, Paul, I just really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. I know it's the work in the Australian time zone thing, and you're very busy, so it was, you know, some challenges in terms of making the link up, but I really appreciate it. This has been a really great conversation. I've taken away a lot, and I'd love to at some point again reach out, have another conversation as things move on. For our listeners, is there a place, anything that you'd like to direct them to, like Twitter or webpage, anything like that?
No, I'm good.
You're good?
Actually, you know what? there's a really good podcast called Defense Research.
Defense Research.
Out of the UNSW Defense Research Institute. So it's one of my offsiders here. He's my senior business development manager, but he's also a great sort of podcast guy, just like you two. He's really well known in Australia, actually. His podcast that made the top 10 or something. But we've done he's done a series of interviews with some really interesting people, including you know, physicists doing research in hypersonics, or some computer scientists doing artificial intelligence, trusted autonomy, machine learning, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, his name is Mick Cook, and the podcast is called Defense Research. You don't have to put it out there if you think it's a competitor or anything, but
no, not at all. and this is our first kind of step into the defense
international relations.
Yeah, and it's an area that I'm actually I'm feeling a lot, I feel a lot more comfortable in talking than some of the issues that we talk about. And so you're kind of the initiator of it. We're going to be doing a bunch more, definitely on things related to like China, Russia, Iran, all that. You know, I would like to provide more visibility on it. I think there's a lot of interesting things to discuss there. Okay. So yeah, thanks for being there for us to kind of kick that off. Okay. We'll definitely be doing that more. And I'll definitely make sure that our listeners know about Defense Research podcast with Mick Cook. That's great. Wonderful.
Okay.
Great.
Well, thank Paul, you. Thank you so much for your time. Take care and keep in touch.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you so much for listening to Unbound. If you enjoyed our conversation, the best way you can help us continue it is to give us a like and a 5-star review wherever you get podcasts. It'd go a long way to help us grow our user base and include more and more people in our conversation. See you next time.